We'll hear argument this morning in case 06157, Hine versus Freedom From Religion Foundation. General Clement.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, in Flast against Cohen, this Court recognized narrow circumstances in which a taxpayer could satisfy the requirements of Article 3 in challenging a congressional exercise of its spending and taxing authority. This Court, in doing so, rejected the suggestion of Justice Douglas that it allow all taxpayers to sue in all manner of claims, as well as the slightly more modest suggestion of Justices Stewart and Fortas that the Court allow taxpayer standing for all Establishment Clause challenges. This Court's subsequent cases, such as Valley Forge, have made clear just how narrow the rule of Flast is. In order for a taxpayer to satisfy the requirements of Article 3, the taxpayer must challenge a congressional exercise of the taxing and spending authority and assert that the act of spending itself is what gives rise to the Establishment Clause violation. The Court of Appeals in the decision below substantially expanded the scope of taxpayer standing. And in doing so, the Court adopted a doctrine that I think can fairly be only understood as an exception to, not an application of, normal principles of Article III standing. The Court did so on the rationale that there is much that the executive branch can do to violate the Establishment Clause. But there is much that all three branches of government could conceivably do to violate the Establishment Clause, and that has never been thought a sufficient reason to extend taxpayer standing to all government action, nor has it been thought a sufficient reason to relax the irreducible minimum requirements of Article III.
If I understand your position correctly, if Congress enacts a program that favors religion over non-religion, which is supposedly what the Establishment Clause prohibits, that's bad. But if Congress enacts a perfectly valid general program and the President implements it in a fashion that favors religion over non-religion, that's okay insofar as the ability of anybody to challenge it is concerned. Is that an accurate description?
Well, I don't think so, Justice Scalia. I mean, I think that may be sort of over-inclusive and under-inclusive, okay, which is to say it's not a congressional program. It's a congressional spending statute that is the key predicate. And then once there's a congressional spending program, whether it's facial challenge or an as-applied challenge that relies on an intervening ministerial act of the executive branch, taxpayer standing will lie under this Court's precedent.
If Congress had enacted this executive order that's in question here, if it had been congressional legislation, would there be standing?
I don't think so, Justice Ginsburg. But let me just be clear. I don't think it's just a matter of there's this executive order that's challenged in this case, and Congress could have enacted that into statute. As I understand it, what is really at issue here is not the executive order. It is the way that certain conferences were conducted by executive branch officials. That's
well,
what
well,
the dispute's
been
narrowed
to. Well, I had the same question as Justice Ginsburg, and I think it was also suggested by Justice Scalia's question. Suppose that Congress passed a statute that said, we hereby appropriate $1 million to the President to use to call religious conferences, and then it spelled out these conferences. Is there standing there?
I don't think so, Justice Kennedy, because I look at this Court's
And I, of course, want the answer. But then why is that consistent with what you told us at the beginning, that there had to be a statute?
Because there has to be two things. There has to be a statute, and then there has to be an allegation that the statute creates a unique injury in the context of spending that affects taxpayers differently than anybody than any other citizen. And if you have a situation like your hypothetical statute, where you don't have any spending that goes outside of the government, then you might have an Establishment Clause problem. But it wouldn't be an Establishment Clause problem where the nub of the problem is the fact that money is spent. Because if there's a problem with
So you're saying if the government, the executive, or the Congress, if the congressional statute authorizes the giving of money for the building of a church, that's bad. But if it authorizes, it makes a general authorization to the President, no, if the congressional statute says the government will build a church, that's okay, because then the money doesn't go outside the government.
Well, importantly, Justice Scalia, it's not a matter of it being okay. It's a question
well,
of whether
as far as standing is concerned, yeah, I mean,
it's logically gives rise to taxpayer standing.
So
and I think there is.
What is your answer to that? That in fact, it's bad in the first situation and okay in the second as far as standing is concerned.
What I would say is in either case it's bad. I would say that there is taxpayer standing to challenge the disbursement of funds outside the government, but not your horrible hypothetical about an internal government church.
There is no standing for the internal government church.
Not taxpayer standing. Anybody who's subjected to the mass at the church probably has standing as a matter of direct.
No, we're not forcing anybody in at gunpoint. We're just building a government church.
Well, with respect, Justice Scalia, nobody forced Van Orden to walk by the Ten Commandments display in Texas at gunpoint, and yet this Court said that he could bring an Establishment Clause challenge. So I think there would be directly injured people who could challenge your sort of end of the slippery slope.
We're talking taxpayer standing, and you think there is a real difference insofar as whether the taxpayer is harmed between the Congress saying we're going to give the money to a religious organization to build a church, and Congress saying we're going to build a church. You really think there's a difference?
I think there's a difference in the extent to which there is a conceptually direct injury for the taxpayer as taxpayer. The citizens are clearly injured when the government sets up a church.
In both cases, money is being used for a purpose that is contrary to the Establishment Clause, according to the taxpayer.
But with respect, in the context of the internal government church, the fact that money is being spent to establish that church is
taxpayers
the least of your
money.
Concerns. It's the fact that the government is establishing it as the principal concern.
I don't care whether it's the least of the concerns. It's a concern. It's the same Establishment Clause concern in both cases. Now, you may well be correct that there's a freedom of religion clause violation in one case and not in the other. But as far as the Establishment Clause violation, I find it difficult to understand the difference between the two.
Well, Justice Scalia, I think it's a difference that's suggested by this Court's cases, and they do make an important distinction between the distribution of money outside the government, where the spending itself is the injury, and what this Court has termed the incidental expenditure of money in the context of an executive branch activity that itself is alleged to violate the Establishment
Clause. Why should that make any difference if the entire theory behind it is sort of the Madisonian theory, if not threepence from the pocket for a religious purpose? If you start with the Madisonian view, there should be no distinction in the two cases that Justice Scalia puts.
I'm not quite sure that's right, Justice Souter, because I think that there's really two ways the government can establish religion. One is they can do it themselves directly. And if they do that, I think that the primary problem is the primary executive branch conduct in doing so. The other way they
Let's talk about establishing, and maybe this is what you're going to do, establishing religion by spending the threepence.
Exactly, and that is precisely
what — In his case, when you build the church, you're spending the threepence, whether a government employee is laying the bricks or an outside contractor is laying the bricks or a third-party institution to which a grant has been made is laying the bricks. It's the same threepence.
Well, but with respect, in the one case, it is the threepence itself that is the establishment violation. It is the very act of handing government money into the coffers of the outside
religious
entity.
I thought it was the very act of taking the money out of the pocket and using it for a particular purpose. And the money comes out of the pocket in each case.
Well,
and the purpose is the same in each case.
I would take issue with that and say that the primary concern that Madison was focused on was the taking of the money and then giving it to the outside religious entity.
You've covered the case where the government itself, the executive is the actor, and you say that's not covered by FLAST. What is covered is if you give the money directly to the religious organization. If the money goes instead of to the government, take this case, if the conferences are run by a private contractor with the executive, where would that fall?
I think it might depend on the nature of the claim, actually. If the nature of the
It's this claim. These conferences are run now instead of within the executive branch by various agencies. They are run by contractors, specialists in conferences that have been engaged by the executive to help people make grant applications.
then I think the better view, if the challenge is exactly this one, which is not that there's something wrong with the recipient, but that there is something wrong with what goes on at these conferences, then in that context, I don't think there would be taxpayer standing.
That's a question on the merits. Right now, we have to take the allegations of the complaint on the merits. The allegation is, I take it, that religious organizations are being favored over secular organizations. But that's a merits question. You've been clear that if the government itself spends the money, then there's no standing. You've been clear that if it gives the money to the religious group, there is standing. Now, money is going outside the government. It's going outside the government, but it's not going to the religious organization. Where do you fit that?
Again, I think if I understand the question, I would say that there's no taxpayer standing there. And I think, but I apologize for sort of bleeding over into the merits, but with all due respect, I don't think you can really meaningfully talk about the FLAST nexus test without bleeding over a little bit into the merits, because the court did it itself in FLAST. And what I would say is, if you have a challenge where the problem is that it's the very act of money going to the third-party conference organizer that's the problem, then it really is a spending case, and I think the taxpayer standing would logically lie. But if it's really what the concern here is, the primary conduct of what was done at the conferences, and not the fact that they're spending on the conferences at all, then I think it is a case that where there would not be taxpayer standing.
There wouldn't be taxpayer standing, but of course there would be regular Article III standing, in the sense that a party claiming to be injured because they didn't get a grant and a religious organization did, and the reason was religion, can bring any kind of claim they want under Article III. It's just they wouldn't qualify for the special exception to the general rule that there is no taxpayer standing for establishment clauses.
That's exactly right, and it's a very important point because, for example, when this Court recognized that the Bible reading in Doremus did not give rise to taxpayer standing, that didn't stop the parents who were directly injured by the same practice in Shemp from bringing an establishment.
Just one more question on this line, and I won't belabor the hypothetical. Again, the federal statute for the conference, and the monies go for air tickets to various religious ministers and priests. So it goes that meets your outside the government test standing there?
I think there would be taxpayer standing if I understand that. And I realize that, you know, one could say, well, that's a fairly artificial distinction, but I do think that it is suggested by this Court's precedents. And the reason that it makes sense is that when you have injury, where the real injury is the spending, the fact that you're not supposed to pay for plane tickets for ministers, that's an Establishment Clause injury, then it makes sense to say that the people that provided that money in the FISC in the first place have a distinct injury.
But not if the President just gives the money out of a general appropriation, authorizing him to give money to people who are helping in the programs that the faith-based initiative was designed to help.
Well,
if the President hands over the money, that's okay.
Not necessarily, Justice Scalia, but it's important to focus on what this case is about.
Why not necessarily? I thought that was your proposition, that it has to be a congressional violation, not an executive.
Right. And it would depend a little bit on where the President is getting the money. I think the way that we would look
at it —
He's
getting the money from Congress under a general appropriation. And he takes this money and he says, here, use it for a religious purpose. That's okay. As far as standing is concerned, he can't be sued.
If he's taking it from a general appropriation that makes no indication that it's to go outside the government, so one could not in any way articulate that as an as-applied challenge to the appropriations, then I suppose that there would not be standing. But I think —
I understand. I'm back row. I'm surprised, and probably my fault. But I thought — I started where Justice Scalia was with his first question. I thought this had something to do with whether Congress passed a statute or the President acted on his own. But listening to you now, I think I can't decide. I think you have a different argument. No. Suppose — I'm just trying to understand it. Suppose that Congress passes a law, and it says it's a very nice thing to commemorate the pilgrims by building a government church at Plymouth Rock, where we will have the regular worship in the Puritan religion. Now, can a taxpayer from California, in your view, challenge that?
I would say that that's a much harder case than this, but I would
but
say
I mean,
no. I would say no to
no,
answer your question.
No, why not? Because I thought FLAST made clear that they could.
No, what FLAST makes clear is that you can challenge a congressional statute that is a taxing and spending statute. And I think to understand the circumstances in which you should give rise to taxpayer standing, you need two things. You need a congressional statute that is an exercise of the taxing and spending authority, but then you need the money to go outside the government. And that's precisely what
You mean go to a private group?
Right, because there's, again, there's two ways to
So you're saying that if the government has the most amazing I'm trying to think of something more amazing than what I just thought of. All over America, they build churches dedicated to one religion, and Congress passes a statute and says, in every city, town, and hamlet, we are going to have a minister, a government minister, a government church, and dedicated to the proposition that this particular sect is the true sect. And they pass a statute like I said, nobody could challenge it.
Horrible hypothetical.
Is that what you're saying, though?
I mean, I think the bottom line is that there would not be taxpayer standing. Plenty of people could probably challenge that.
Well, I don't know. Everybody else who doesn't want to go just avoids it. So they don't have to do anything. They just
presumably any other denomination that is not the established church could bring a challenge that they're being discriminated against because they're favoring a particular church over them. Your proposition is simply that somebody in Oregon can't challenge the fact that they're building a church in Florida simply because the person in Oregon pays taxes, right?
Exactly, and not just the person in Oregon, but everybody in between Oregon and Florida all have the same amount of standing. No, what we're saying is plenty of people would be able to challenge that, but not
who?
As the Chief Justice suggested, I think anybody from a different denomination that said that this was discriminatory probably could bring a claim.
I also think
that anybody who walked into one of those churches could bring the claim. And again, this court.
They don't walk into it because it's not our church, so they don't walk into it.
Moreover, they don't
feel it's discriminatory. It's just we're doing this to commemorate the pilgrims, and we'll give the money to any group that's a pilgrim.
With respect, Justice Breyer, I think you're underestimating the ingenuity of plaintiffs to think that somebody that walked by going to Plymouth Rock thinking I was going to see a nice historical exhibit and is forced to see a church wouldn't bring an action and that there wouldn't be Article III standing for that particular individual,
General Clement, the
taxpayer.
Are you arguing that these lines that you're drawing make a lot of sense in an abstract sense, or are you just arguing that this is the best that can be done within the body of precedent that the court has handed down in this area?
The latter, Justice Alito, and I appreciate the question.
Why didn't you say so? I've been trying to make sense out of what you're saying.
Well, and I've been trying to make sense out of this court's precedents, and the best that I can do when I put together
FLAST. Well, do you think we have a duty to follow precedents that don't make any sense?
Well, I think as a matter of first course, the court tries. And here, if I could put the precedents on a map, though, I do think they make a modicum of sense in the following way. You start with FLAST. FLAST says that you can bring a challenge to a congressional spending statute. Okay, fair enough. Valley Forge comes along and says that you don't have taxpayer standing to challenge an executive branch action. Now, that raises very obvious.
It was because it was under the property clause and they made a distinction between property and money.
Well,
we're talking about money, not property.
But Justice Ginsburg, in fairness, the court could not have been more clear in Valley Forge that there were two reasons that there weren't taxpayers standing there. One was there was a challenge to executive branch action. The second was that it was the property clause rather than the spending clause. Now, you could sort of take the view that the third of the cases, Kendrick, overrules the first aspect of the decision in Valley Forge. Now, I think that's wrong. I think the way to understand Kendrick is as follows. You have a decision that says you can challenge congressional spending, not executive branch action. That naturally poses the question, well, what about an as-applied challenge to a spending statute? Surely, I mean, because spending is something only the Congress does, and disbursement is a ministerial act that only the executive does, I mean, what do you do when there's an intervening ministerial act of disbursement? Does that mean that it's still an as-applied challenge to the spending statute?
Or does that mean
that it's executive branch act?
Was it just a ministerial act, or did the executive have discretion in Bowen about who would receive the grant?
Well, Justice Ginsburg, two things. One, in Bowen, there was a degree of discretion. But it is worth noting that in Bowen, as in FLAST, the statute itself on its face made clear that money was to go to outside entities that were religion. In Bowen, it did so in express terms by four times referring to religious organizations. In FLAST, it did so by saying that money was going to go, or in-kind aid, rather, was going to go to private schools. And that was at a time when this court, roughly contemporaneously in Lemon v. Kurtzman, said that 93% of the private schools were religious. So both of those, the gravamen of what's the complaint, that money is being spent by Congress on religious entities, was not within the discretion of the executive branch. And again, the way I would understand Kendrick is simply reconciling Valley Forge and FLAST v. Cohen to preserve not broad challenges to executive branch action, which would have overruled Valley Forge, but rather to simply preserve the notion that you can bring an as-applied challenge to a spending statute.
But you could reconcile Valley Forge simply by saying when it's money from the Federal Treasury, whether it's a general appropriation or a specific appropriation, it's money from the Treasury, and that's what FLAST is about, because whether it's spent by the executive under an executive program, which you have said can violate the Establishment Clause as well as a congressional program. So why isn't that the line to draw based on FLAST, that it's money from the Treasury that makes the difference?
Well, Justice Ginsburg, it's certainly not the line I would draw from reading these cases side by side and together.
Or to put it another way, to put Justice Ginsburg's point another way, every executive action that involves the expenditure of congressionally authorized funds is an as-applied challenge to an expenditure statute. Because the only way the statute is applied is through executive action. And whenever the executive spends the funds improperly, you have an as-applied challenge to the congressional statute authorizing the funds, whether it's a general statute or more single-shot statute.
Justice Scalia, I would have said that no one would have conceptualized that as an as-applied challenge to a general appropriation statute. I mean, I guess you would, but even if you would do that in another case, I don't see how you could do it in this case. If you look at their complaint, they don't identify a single appropriation statute that they take issue with. Even before the Seventh Circuit, if you look at page 10A of the petition appendix,
that's the essence of an as-applied challenge. You say the statute's okay. It's just what is being done under the statute that is bad. You don't have to identify a bad statute. You're saying it's a perfectly good statute, but the President is violating the Constitution in the way that he's applying it.
With respect, Justice Scalia, I've never heard of an as-applied challenge to a statute that doesn't identify the statute that's unconstitutional as applied. And if
so
you're right
— Under that approach, when a U.S. Marshal executes a search and there's a Fourth Amendment claim that the search is illegal — that's really a challenge to the appropriation of the Marshals Service on an as-applied basis.
That's exactly right, Mr. Chief Justice. And every constitutional right could be sort of kind of transmogrified into a claim that, oh, that's an as-applied appropriations challenge because the government's not supposed to spend money to do unlawful things.
So what's wrong with just saying that FLAST stands for the proposition that when the government spends money in violation of the Establishment Clause, a taxpayer — after all, the money comes from the taxpayer, can bring a lawsuit. And the reason that they do that is because the Establishment Clause is an important joint part of the religion clauses, and there'd be no other way to bring such a challenge. And so it has that simple principle. And when you depart from that principle, say by giving property away instead of giving money away, you don't have the standing. So we have a pretty clear, simple rule. That rule applies whether it's Congress or the President acting under congressional authority, et cetera, which I think is close to what the other side.
Can I just add this thought before you answer? And isn't that exactly what Justice Stewart said in his concurring opinion?
Absolutely. I mean, if this Court wants to go the route of Justice Stewart, which it pointedly rejected, a majority of the Court pointedly rejected in FLAST, and say, Establishment Clause challenges, we're going to relax the normal Article III standards. Now, I'm not quite sure where the Court gets the authority to relax the normal Article III standards, but assuming that
would be — Because there is a real case or controversy, because people become terribly upset when they see some other religion getting the money for the state, for building a church, for example. And that's why there's
upset,
a real controversy.
Getting upset is a constitutionally adequate reason to bring a lawsuit.
Yeah,
people get upset about spending money for purposes that the federal government is not allowed to spend money for because of states' rights. That also would justify Article III standing, wouldn't it?
I suppose under that theory, and obviously the plaintiffs in Richardson and Schlesinger were very upset as well.
It's the kind of thing that is the kind of upset that is a genuine injury if you look to the objectives of the Establishment Clause. And possibly that kind of genuine injury is not the case when you look to objectives of various other clauses of the Constitution.
Justice Breyer, let me try to answer in two ways, if I can. One is to say that that way of looking at it takes you even beyond where Justice Brennan was in Valley Forge. Even Justice Brennan would have drawn the line at what he called bestowals of government largesse to third parties.
That's what I was saying. I said that FLAST then encapsulates that principle drawn out of the objectives of the Establishment Clause in a rule. And the rule is what I suggested.
Based on money. But again, he didn't say just spending the money to do the executive branch's everyday operations and maybe on one day they go a little too far in praising religion. He said the bestowal of government largesse outside the government. The second point I would make is I still don't understand where in just being upset you satisfy the irreducible minimum requirements of Article 3. And even though FLAST is probably the outer limit of what's an Article III injury under normal principles, there is at least what Judge Leventhal in Public Citizen against Simon called conceptual directness between the injury to the taxpayer and the injury that comes when tax money is spent outside the government to a religious entity. And he differentiated that from what happens when you have general executive branch activity that's unlawful, where he said there's no similar arrow between the action and taxpayers as a class. It's a classic injury that's inflicted on everybody. It's a generalized grievance which has never been said to satisfy Article 3.
An incidental expenditure as part of a regulatory program is quite different from looking at a discrete program. The faith-based initiative is a discrete program, and one component of it is the set of conferences. This is not an incidental something pursuant to a large regulatory program. Faith-based initiative is the name of this program.
But, Justice Ginsburg, their challenge is not that the money that's spent on conferences can't be spent on conferences. Their challenge is that what happened at the conference is there was too much promotion of religion. The fact that the money was spent on the conferences is incidental to the gravamen of their complaint, if I may save my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, General Clement. Mr. Pincus?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The government's argument here is that FLAST needs major surgery. And as the discussion, I think, in the first part of the argument shows, it's proposing two very substantial limitations that bear no relation to the relevant Establishment Clause principles, the history of the clause, or to this Court's decisions. And we think there's no basis for drawing the arbitrary lines that the government suggests. And maybe I can just follow up on some of my the points that my colleagues made and that the Court made during the questioning. First of all, with respect to the argument that the money has to go outside the government, there's certainly nothing in this Court's cases that say that, and the lower courts and this Court, at least in part, have found taxpayers standing to challenge the salaries paid to chaplains that are employed by the government, and of course those
I guess that's where my first question is. I don't understand, under your theory, why any taxpayer couldn't sue our marshal for standing up and saying, God save the United States in this honorable court. Her salary comes from Congress. You can trace that under your traceability requirement. So any taxpayer, under your theory, could bring that lawsuit.
Well, I don't think that lawsuit could be brought, Mr. Chief Justice, and let me explain why. We think that the limitations that are in this Court's opinions require the taxpayer to identify a discrete and identifiable non-incidental expenditure. In other words, it's not just any
I can identify it. It's the appropriations that Congress extends to this Court that pay the salary of the marshal.
But, Your Honor, those appropriations don't do the trick. And maybe I can just explain our test and explain why. The Court in Doremus explained why they were standing in Everson to challenge the payments for bus transportation by saying Everson showed a measurable appropriation or disbursement of school district funds occasioned solely by the activities complained of. In other words, there had to be the violation caused some unique expenditure. Not that the monies wouldn't have been expended, because in this context the taxpayer doesn't have to show a lower tax burden, but
Mr. Pincus,
there
have been federal spending programs that have been declared unconstitutional under the Establishment Clause. And can you cite any instance in which such a holding has caused a reduction in tax rates.
No, and this Court has said, and the lower courts have said, that that is not the requirement, because the injury here that the taxpayer complains of, as the Court said in Daimler-Chrysler, is not an increased tax burden. The injury is the expenditure of funds in a way that violates the establishment.
Your traceability either covers every case or it covers no case. In real-world taxation terms, no case would ever meet the test. But in purely conceptual terms, is any federal money being spent? Every case involving any expenditure of money, even the portion of the marshal's salary that is devoted to convening the court in the morning, would be sufficient.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, that's not what the Court said in Doremus in describing Everson. It didn't say the mere fact that some money was being spent was enough. It said that there was a measurable appropriation or disbursement occasioned solely by the activities complained of.
Let me give you something more measurable. It is easy to tell from timesheets and other things how much money is expended on Air Force One and on security for the president when he goes to address a religious organization, okay? And he urges the importance of religion in American life and so forth. The whole trip is about religion. That's measurable.
It is measurable, Your Honor.
Would a taxpayer have standing to choose?
I don't think so, because as the Court of Appeals said, that this Court has identified a second limitation, which is not incidental. The money has to be central. The money that's being challenged has to be central to the violation, just as you couldn't challenge a prayer breakfast.
I don't understand. The money — say it again.
The money has to be central to the violation.
You mean Congress has to
— No. It can be — I mean, in this case, for example, the challenge is — that these conferences were the entire conference program was a program to prefer religion over non-religion.
Well, what about Bowman? The money wasn't central to the violation there.
It was a
pregnancy program, and the executive added to it certain restrictions that were challenged as being religiously based.
But the as-applied —
And we allowed an as-applied challenge.
You did, an as-applied challenge to specific grants. There were specific grants identified, and there was an as-applied challenge, because the argument
this
was —
This is a specific grant. There is money allocated to the White House, which goes — you can identify it in the budget. And some of it goes to Air Force One, some of it goes to the payment of the security guards.
Yes, Your Honor, but the money that's identified in the budget is not — it's not the entire Air Force One appropriation that would be challenged in the kind of claim you're positing.
It wasn't in Bowen either.
But it was a specific — there was a specific action that allocated a specific amount of money to those grantees. And the argument was those grantees weren't entitled to any of that money because the way they were using it violated the Establishment Clause. And so there was the government's own action by designating a specific sum of money in that grant, identified a specific sum of money, and the challenge was to that entire expenditure as identified by the government.
I really don't think you're just — I mean, there's an identified sum of money that goes to pay the costs of Air Force One, too, to buy the gas and everything else. There's an identified sum of money that goes into the pockets of the security guards who protect the president. I mean, it really doesn't make any sense.
Well, Your Honor, I think there, as I say, there are two tests. One is whether there's an identifiable sum, as we were talking about with respect to grants or the easiest case. There's another case as when there's a challenge to an entire program that the government has identified as a particular program. And then the second question that the Court has identified in FLAST was, is it incidental or not? Is it something that is peripheral?
So take Justice Breyer's Pilgrim Church, under your theory, if the grant was to erect a memorial and suitable museums or whatever at Plymouth Rock, then there wouldn't be an identifiable sum if the government said, hey, let's use some of this money to build a church.
No, if the government then singled out some of that money and said
if the government singles it out, by that you mean the executive was implementing
branch.
It as opposed to Congress.
Yes, I think.
How do they? In other words, if they spend the money, are they singling it out? If it turns out it costs $1 million to build the little pilgrim church, is that an identifiable sum? singled out that would satisfy your requirement?
Well, I don't think the singling out, I don't think whether it's discrete and identifiable depends on the amount, Your Honor. I think it depends on how, whether there is a way, and this really is part of both traceability and redressability. There has to be a way to identify the expenditure that the taxpayer is seeking to enjoin. And if there is some separate government grant for the building of a church, yes, if it's if there is some religious activity,
it doesn't have to be a grant, just that you can say it costs
or a contract.
So much money.
Yes. If the government lets a contract for the building of the church, yes,
or the contract hiring the security guards who protect the president, right? They're employed. That's an employment contract.
Well, they are, and they're
protecting him for a religious purpose. He's going to this religious.
Well, they're protecting him for a protection purpose. His trip is for a religious purpose. And I think our submission is that there is a distinction that can be drawn there.
This is money that is expended in order to enable the president to do something for a religious purpose. It wouldn't be expended but for the fact that he chose to make this religious trip.
But as with buying the bagels at a prayer breakfast, the cost of the bagels, like the cost of the security, is not paying for the center of what the violation is, and therefore we think that that's a basis for a rule that rules those types of expenditures
out. It wasn't the center in Bowen either.
Bowen was
programs to combat pregnancy, and some of the organizations that were getting the money were placing conditions on it. It wasn't central to the program. It was something added that the challenger said shouldn't have been added.
But their claim was the spending of this entire grant is unconstitutional because of the way the money is going to be used by the grantees. It wasn't that $1.98 of the grant is unconstitutional and the other $1 million is okay. It was that the because of the way the grantee was using the money, the entire grant is unconstitutional.
Oh, we think that's a different case. It had only come within your theory if there was one Secret Service agent who was assigned to religious trips of the president, then his entire salary could be challenged. But if it's just some of the salary of a Secret Service agent who protects the president for all sorts of trips, that can't be challenged.
Yes, and we
and
think
that makes a lot of sense.
Well, it does make sense because unlike the government's limitations, which have nothing to do with the rationale of FLAST or the underlying threepence fear of James Madison, that does. That is a particular amount of money that the government is spending, and it's identifiable just because of religion.
If we rule in your favor, then every government agency has to make sure that whatever activities they undertake are part of a broader office. They don't set up a separate White House office. They just run it out of the White House office. Purely formalistic distinction.
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think it preserves,
it's central or not. If you have a White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, then you could say it's central to it. If it's just the White House office, then the argument would be, no, that's not central. They do a lot of other stuff as well.
Well, but if there are particular people in that office or a particular separately called out program in that office that is focused on faith-based initiatives only, yes.
You have to decide what unit you're looking at before deciding whether the activity is central. And you're just saying, well, just look at the people who are doing the offensive activity. That's obviously going to be central to what they're doing.
Your Honor, I think I haven't been clear in the test that I'm suggesting.
I'd like you to go back to an answer you gave because it sounds to me like it wasn't right. The president needs protection at all times, no matter where he goes. The president may be doing something that violates the Establishment Clause, but protection is the job, and it doesn't make any difference where the president is. And so your answer to the question, well, suppose he had a special protector who just took care of his religious activities, I would still say that it's protection is the thing. So I don't — and I think that you didn't — the answer that you gave isn't consistent with your theory of this case.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that's because there are two steps to our analysis, Justice Ginsburg. One is there a discrete and identifiable expenditure that only arises with respect to religious activities? The second question is, is that particular expenditure an incidental one? FLAST said incidental expenditures don't give rise to standing. And I think you're right. In that situation, that expenditure.
But in response to Justice Ginsburg's point, you could have said the same thing about the expenditure in Bowen. That money would have been spent anyway.
The question,
it happened to have been spent badly, but it would have been spent anyway.
But it would have been spent differently, Your Honor. And I think that's the critical.
That was her point, that it would have been spent differently. If the President hadn't gone to this religious event, he would have gone somewhere else, and the money would have been spent differently.
But
that didn't make the difference in Bowen. Why should it make the difference here?
Well,
the fact is,
I think
it was spent for a bad purpose, and that's the essential grievance of the plaintiff, it seems to me.
We agree completely. But we also agree that there are some limits, that the Court has said that every single dollar that's expended for a bad purpose doesn't give rise to a challenge. In my example, if there's a prayer breakfast and all the only money that's spent is on the bagels, we don't believe that the bagels are the basis for a taxpayer challenge to the prayer breakfast. And so
in fact, you have — just help me with one point here. I mean, I see that deciding what's incidental and what isn't incidental will be difficult. And I guess many of these cases would end up being decided on the merits. There is no violation on the merits, or maybe sometimes there is. But I'd started thinking of the question of standing by thinking that there are strong feelings when the government spends money in favor of one religion and not another. After all, they led to the 30 years' war. We see that in other places in the world today. People feel strong. And if, in fact, they have that terribly strong feeling and can't make any challenge because these feelings are shared by many, then there are no cases in the courts at all. And the government can do what it wants without challenge. So in FLAST, they carved out an exception. And the exception was where the taxing and spending clauses were involved because Madison and others said this is aimed at government shall not tax and spend. So that was my theory. And all we're saying is, where there's a big taxing and spending and it isn't incidental, there's standing. Now we'll worry about the merits, simple and clear. To which the response was, which has me a little worried, frankly, was that, that was Justice Stewart's position, or roughly speaking, but the Court rejected that quite clearly. And if you look at later cases, they reject it too. And therefore, whatever you might think of it, it isn't the law. And I'm not free to think whatever. I have to think exactly in accordance with what the case has said. So what is your response? I'd like you to focus on that.
Well, respectfully, I think that's exactly what Justice Stewart said. Justice Stewart, in his concurrence, did not espouse a broader theory than the one that the Court adopted in FLAST. And he said he joined the judgment of the opinion of the Court, and he said, I understand it to hold only that a federal taxpayer has standing to assert that a specific expenditure of federal funds violates the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment.
You're saying that what Justice Stewart's view, insofar as it was rejected, that FLAST suggested even broader standing. But it suggested at least what Justice Stewart said.
Yes, I think.
Is that right or not?
Yes, I think
say
that's
it's right if it's not, because I'll.
If Justice Stewart agreed with what the Court said, why did he write a separate opinion?
Well, sometimes, despite the Court's desire sometimes to have a less separate opinion, sometimes justices do. And what he said here is he was just explaining his reason why he believed that FLAST was distinguishable from Frothingham and notes specifically that taxpayers have a clear stake because of the threepence comment. Justice Fortas did have a broader theory, although he, in addition, that the Court did not adopt, but he also said recognize in very similar language to Justice Stewart what the Court's opinion held. So I think Justice Stewart's opinion is useful because he doesn't talk about Congress. He talks about expenditures.
It seems to me unduly intrusive for the courts to tell the President that it cannot talk to specific groups to see if they have certain talents that the government may use to make sure that all of their energies are used properly by the federal government. It's almost like a speech rationale. And perhaps you would say that's just a judgment on the merits. But it seems to me that there's a standing concern here, too, that we would be supervising the White House and what it can say, whom we can talk to. And it seems to me that's quite intrusive from the standpoint of standing purposes. I'm not sure that this makes a standard that distinguishes the case from FLAST, colon, and or brings it within those cases.
Well, Your Honor, we believe that the incidental test and what I've been talking about in terms of what the limits are, that it has to be a non-incidental expenditure, protects against that. Because if the argument is some government official for part of his day met with three ministers, and therefore we want to challenge because government shouldn't be meeting with ministers, I think it's both for the reason, both because of the fact that this is not an argument that the expenditure on the hour of his day that it took to have those meetings is clearly not central to anything.
You really want to condemn the federal courts to deciding case by case at the instance of all these people who feel passionately about this, case by case, whether the expenditure was incidental or not. It doesn't seem to me an intelligent expenditure of any sensible person's time.
To add to the question before you answer, at the jurisdictional stage, in other words, this would be litigation over whether the individual taxpayer has standing, the court would first have to determine whether the activity you're challenging is incidental or not.
Well, Your Honor, I think the fact that there haven't been a lot of these challenges that the government's been able to point to indicates that this may not be a big problem.
Well, it may indicate they're reading FLAST different than you read it. There are not a lot of these challenges because you don't have standing under FLAST.
But the court also said in Allen against Wright, you know, the absence of precise standards does not leave the courts at sea in applying the law of standing. Standing isn't an area, really, that is susceptible to precise definitions. It seems to me that both because of the incidental test and the concerns that Justice Kennedy articulated, if someone's claim is people in the White House had five meetings in the course of a year that they're upset about, it would not take much at the jurisdictional stage even if it's true.
But then five meetings isn't enough. How many?
I mean, what about 10?
20.
I was about to ask you. 20.
Well, Your Honor, our position —
We'll litigate it. We'll figure out a number eventually, I'm sure.
Well, you know, In Allen against Wright and Linda R.S., there are a whole series of cases where this court has set up guidance and the lower courts have evaluated whether the connection between the challenged conduct and the claimed injury, here the expenditure, is close enough for there to be standing. And this, the inquiry that we're suggesting really isn't that different.
What would happen if when this program was set up, nothing was said about faith whatsoever? This was just going to be a general program of outreach to community service organizations. But plaintiffs claimed that as the program was being administered, it was heavily favoring religious organizations. Would that come out the same way in your judgment?
If their challenge was to the whole program, essentially, as the Court of Appeals characterized the complaint here, the whole program essentially is facially neutral, but in reality is a preference, yes, then it would come out the same way. And the question would be, with respect —
It depends totally on how they characterize.
Well, that's true in many standing questions. The question is, how do you characterize the claim? But the
claim, the gravamen here is the government is doing stuff with money that's been taxed for me that it shouldn't do. I fail to see how it makes any difference to the people who care so passionately about this, as Justice Breyer suggests, whether it's just an incidental expenditure or whether it's part of a targeted program. We don't do that in any other area of constitutional law. If someone has been subjected to an unreasonable search and seizure, we don't say, well, you know, it was just incidental. Yeah, we know you feel badly about it, but this was just an incidental search and seizure, and you don't have standing. It doesn't make any sense, given the gravamen that you're directing this law against, to establish such a standard.
Well, Your Honor, it is the standard that the Court established in FLAST. It is what the Court —
You also acknowledge we're not here to try to make sense.
No, I actually think the Court's precedents line up pretty neatly. I think —
But not neatly in terms of the purposes of the thing. Are your clients claiming that it would violate the Establishment Clause for the President to go to lots and lots of prayer breakfasts?
No, we're not.
No. I've never met anyone who did, but I guess there is a legitimate concern. Somebody might think that, I guess, and I guess that if people, there's some tendency of the worried people that are worried, you know, they're pro se, they're all kinds of people. Somebody could claim that, so you want a way to keep them out.
You want a way to keep them out.
It's Justice Kennedy's concern.
Exactly. You want a way to keep them out.
Yeah, but what they're worried about is, will this word incidental and be sufficient to keep out
the people who might somehow decide they want a claim, which sounds like a frivolous claim, but that the president can't go to a prayer breakfast. Now, does the word incidental do that? That's what I
think. Well, our submission is that it does, Your Honor, because we think,
I asked this before, and I think you were cut off before you had a chance. Incidental with respect to what? All of the money for a particular meeting, a particular breakfast, a particular whatever, is it incidental to that, or is it incidental to however many times the president has breakfast, if he goes to a prayer breakfast?
No, it's incidental to what's the focus of the claim. The focus of the claim isn't that bagels were served. The focus of the claim is there was prayer and that it was a religious meeting, if there is just to think of what such a claim might be. And so if the expenditure that's been identified is the bagels, it really is pretty tangential compared to the focus of what someone's complaining about. And so we think that's a rational test for doing what Justice Kennedy was concerned about.
So if the expenditure is very small, but to take a particular religious symbol that might be offensive to some other people, is that incidental because the meeting went on longer and cost more than the particular religious symbol?
No, I think there would be two challenges, because there would be a challenge to the government's purchase of the religious symbol to have at the meeting in addition to the meeting.
And if it was $2, you would say it's not incidental because it covered the whole cost of purchasing the religious symbol.
Yes, I don't think this is, and I think the government agrees with this, I don't think this is a test about how much. I think this is a test about the relationship between the expenditure that's challenged and the claim, what's alleged to be unlawful about this complex of government activity.
So there's no standing to challenge a presidential directive which says we are going to buy bagels for all evangelistic Christian breakfasts. Okay? Why would there be standing?
Because there the challenge is to the discriminatory purchase. It's not about the prayer breakfast. It's about the idea that the government is purchasing bagels in a religiously non-neutral way.
Of course, but the point is that
makes... So there absolutely would be standing.
But that shows how totally manipulable your incidental test is. You just have to phrase your claim so that it covers whatever expenditure offending you. It's not — incidental doesn't protect you from frivolous or insignificant claims in any way.
Your Honor, I think it does, because there would have to be an allegation in that situation that bagels were being purchased on a religious basis, and that's going to be awfully hard for a lawyer to sign in good faith. I think
How does that confer standing? How does that confer standing?
The idea that bagels are being purchased only for the evangelicals and not for Jewish breakfasts?
Right.
Because the government...
Standing by Joe Doakes, not from somebody who's starting a Jewish prayer breakfast and says, you know, what could be worse than not buying bagels for a Jewish prayer breakfast?
Because you're
him, I can understand. He has standing. But I'm just talking about one of these many people who feel passionately about this, just in general.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think...
He says, he can't do this because I'm a taxpayer, and you say, I'm sorry, being a taxpayer is not enough. We don't care how passionately you feel about it.
I don't think general passion is enough. I think what the court has said is there has to be a tie. And let me say that I think what's critical here is any test, obviously, is susceptible to hypotheticals. But the government, our test at least, keeps in taxpayer standing the core of what the framers were worried about, which is government expenditure of funds.
Mr. Pincus,
yes.
Can I ask you this question? Do you think your theory is consistent with Valley Forge?
Yes, Your Honor, we do. Because in Valley Forge, first of all, as Justice Ginsburg said, the court relied on the fact that it was a property clause claim. There is a passage in Valley Forge that refers to executive action, but the court in Kendrick, when it talked about Valley Forge, said, in characterizing that case, said executive action pursuant to the property clause. And we think those things are tied together, and there's a reason why. In the appropriations context, there always is congressional action with respect to the very money that's at issue, because there has to be a congressional appropriation. That's not true in the property context. Congress doesn't have to pass a statute saying, here are the 58 property sites that we want the executive to get rid of.
Do you think the distinction between taxing and spending and the property clause makes any sense? Do you think James Madison would not be upset if the Commonwealth of Virginia transferred 10,000 acres to the Anglican Church? That would be okay, but the threepence would, in taxation, would not?
Well, I think that the core of what was the concern was the taking of the money and the using it for religious purposes. And I think what
well,
the court
it's
did
the same money used. It's not the same.
No, it's not the
it
same.
It goes into some pot of fungible money, and it's other money used. So instead of using other money, you use land. Does
but
that
I
make
think
a difference?
Well, I think that the court decided that it made a difference, and I think in terms of cabining, in terms of the worry that perhaps FLAST was going to be overbroad and the need to have Congress involved, which I think is key, there was no congressional involvement at all in designating those properties than there is in the appropriations context, and I think that's a key difference. But I think what's important here, and the court's colloquy in the first part of the argument showed it, is that the government's position, the idea that it's only grants to third parties, means the government could hire a corps of chaplains and send them out to civilians and to the populace at large, and that couldn't be challenged because all it is executive pay. And the idea that there's some difference between a Bowen v. Kendrick situation, where the executive had tremendous discretion in terms of where it was going to give the money, and the situation here, which is the exercise of precisely the same executive discretion, makes no sense. The injury is the same. The conduct that's the core of the violation is the same. It's an executive branch decision to use funds in a way that's impermissible under the Establishment Clause. And we think drawing the lines that the government is trying to draw just make no sense and leave out insulated from any taxpayer challenge, really huge swaths of conduct that is really at the very core of what Madison was concerned about. And so our submission is that that really makes no sense. There's no basis in history, for example, for the government's claim that executive branch decisions are somehow different and insulated with respect to spending. It's the spending of the same thruppence. And if history indicates anything, it's that concerns about establishment were focused just as much on the king as on the parliament in terms of the history that the framers understood. And so the idea that the executive would be given free rein to exercise discretion with respect to spending and there would be no concern about the types of injuries that gave rise to FLAST, we think is just not right. If the court has no further questions, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pincus. General Clement, you have 3 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Just a few points in rebuttal. First of all, I think it's important to emphasize that if this Court recognizes that there is not taxpayer standing, that does not mean that there won't be lawsuits, that there won't be directly injured plaintiffs that can bring claims. Doremus and Shemp prove that point. But even more broadly, any time the Establishment Clause injury takes the form of alleged coercive conduct, the individuals who are coerced are going to have standing to bring the suit. The second point to make clear is it's just not an accurate description of this Court's cases to say that the spending of appropriated funds by the executive is enough to give rise to taxpayer standing. The property distribution plan at issue in Valley Forge took a tremendous amount of appropriated funds to run. Nobody thought that was a basis for taxpayer standing. The Bibles that were purchased and the salaries of the teachers in Doremus presumably cost at least a threepence, but that was not found enough. Now, I think in trying to understand the Court's cases, you really have to focus on this word incidental. And I think that the colloquy in the second half of the argument shows that you can't look at incidental as being minimal. It doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean minimal. It doesn't mean incremental. It is trying to distinguish an incidental expenditure of funds when, as to something where the expenditure of funds is central or vital to the Establishment Clause violation. In the context of money going to third-party religious entities, nobody would say that the spending is incidental. It's the whole violation. In the context of Bible reading or anything else the executive branch does, the fact that money went to fund the executive branch to violate the Establishment Clause is the least of the problems. The problem is the primary conduct of the executive branch in violating the Establishment Clause, but that's not a spending injury. The funding that goes into that is incidental. I think that's the way to make sense of this Court's cases. It's important to emphasize what's at issue here. It's not a general challenge to the faith-based office. It's not a challenge to the name of the office. It is a challenge to particular conferences and the assertion that the executive branch officials at the conferences spent too much time talking about faith-based groups and not enough talking about community-based groups. If that isn't intrusive on the executive branch, I don't know what is. The last point I would leave you with is that if something has to go in this area, if you have to choose between the logic of FLAST and the irreducible minimum minimum requirements of Article III, I think it's an easy choice. You don't abandon the basic requirements of Article III that distinguish the judiciary from the political branches of governments. I think the Seventh Circuit, with all due respect, lost sight of that. Its decision should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, General. The case is submitted.